Okay, this is Bill Claus. Welcome to Radioactive Magazine, and we have a very special guest on tonight's show, an old friend of mine, Judy Ansel, who is the founder and executive director of the Heartland Labor Forum for nearly 30 years now.
28.
Well, that's nearly 30. What your title, is it still the Institute for Labor Studies?
No, it's not.
Well, okay, then help me
we
out
We changed
here.
Our name a few years ago to UMKC Worker Education and Labor Studies.
And before that, it was the Institute for Labor Studies. And that also goes back about 30 years as well, doesn't it?
It goes back to the mid-'80s.
Mid-'80s, oh, even longer then. And founding member and driving force of Cross Border Network. So how long has Cross Border Network been around?
It was founded in 1997. So okay. 20 years.
Okay. And it deals with issues of immigration and building coalitions and networking between workers in this country and Latin America. Or
yes.
Help me, that
yeah.
Sounded pretty well?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to take Judy a little bit out of her comfort zone because when we were talking before about what we were going to talk about on the show, she said she'd rather talk about anything but herself. But then a couple of days ago, Judy gives training on how to do radio interviews, and she says, be sure you tell a story. So I'm going to just throw that right back at her and have Judy tell the story of how a Chicago girl, and I say that because compared to now, you were a girl in those days, came here from Chicago and how you ended up in Kansas City, how you ended up with Institute for Labor Studies and the Heartland Labor Forum. Just tell your story.
If you My gosh.
Start before actually. Did you bring your passion for the labor movement to the Institute for Labor Studies, or did you develop it as a result of teaching at the Institute for Labor Studies?
Oh, I was a labor activist long before I was
So tell us about
educator.
That part of your life, the before.
Well,
because that's the part I don't know, really.
You don't know that part. Huh? Well, I was born in Chicago, all right?
Dark and stormy
you can play
night.
The music. But I came to Kansas City by way of San Francisco, actually, and left Chicago when I was 18. Grew up in a working class neighborhood and then a upper middle class neighborhood. And I think the contrast between the two of them really made me much more class conscious than I otherwise would have been, because I got to see how the two different groups lived and their values and lifestyles. And so it made me very sensitive to people's different positions in life, I think. And then, I went to college in the 60s. I'm a child of the 60s in many ways. I became an activist in the 60s. I think my first demonstration I went on was a civil rights demonstration in probably about 1962 for fair housing. And I remember walking on this picket line with all these people and carrying a sign and feeling totally embarrassed because people were looking at me. But I got used to it and have been on uncountable number of picket lines since then.
Well, you're mid the teens at that?
Yeah, I was in high school.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. All right. So I went off to college, and of course it was the 60s, and I got involved in two different things. When I got to college, I was living in a dorm, and the girls had to be in by 10 o'clock at night on weeknights and midnight on weekends. And we had to sign out after 10 o'clock on weekends and say where we were going. And there were no rules at all for the boys. And always being somebody who noticed the gender differences, because I had an older brother, I thought that was really unfair. And I got myself on the university social regulations committee. And I think there must have been some like-minded young women there with me, and we started asking questions about why there was such great inequality. And through a number of things that happened, including a huge scandal with the dean of women who got caught using freshman women as spies in English classes to report on bad language from the teaching assistants, she fell, and so did the social regulations. And then we started campaigning to get women the right to live off campus. And by the end of my 4 years at college, we had completely changed the rules And that was a real taste of success. You know, I learned that protest worked. At the same time, of course, everybody else was involved in the movement against the Vietnam War. And, you know, there were numerous demonstrations in San Francisco, Berkeley.
Did you get involved with that as well?
Yeah, I got involved, but less directly involved than I was in the campus activities and campus protests. So by the time I graduated from college, I was a pretty confirmed activist.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you were successful in your early experiences, because that certainly isn't the case for a lot of people. You think your life trajectory may have changed if you'd been unsuccessful? Well, I mean, who knows?
The 60s were a period of success for lots of folks. I mean, the civil rights movement made enormous progress. The women's movement was born and began to make tremendous changes by the early 70s. And the anti-Vietnam War movement was successful. I mean, we did eventually stop the war. It took years. But there were a lot of people who experienced activism as a very positive thing, not, you know, something where there was constantly frustration and loss and frustration. That was in the later period.
Yeah.
You know, because after the mid-70s, I mean, the whole tenor of the country changed, and it was much more difficult to win things after that, I'd say.
Well, I didn't intend to go this trajectory, but, you know, there seems to be an increase in activism these days.
And absolutely.
It seems
it's
to be
nice
kind
to
of
see.
Being reborn again. So I'm wondering if maybe some of those positive changes are ahead of us.
Well, I certainly hope so. I've been waiting for this a long time, and I'm really, you know, very excited about the upsurge of social protests that we're seeing in so many different fronts in not just the U.S. but in the world today. And, you know, I hope that another generation is experiencing the thrill, really, of being able to feel like you can change the world.
Yeah. After that, what was your first experience with labor unions? Before Heartland Labor Forum, before Institute for Labor Studies, you were involved with a local union, I believe.
My first experience was as a member of the American Federation of Teachers. I was teaching college in California, community college. In fact, I was teaching it at 1.5 colleges because I was an adjunct. And
boy, some of those issues haven't changed.
I hit the job market in 1974. I got a master's degree and hit the job market in California. And I remember one dean telling me at a community college, he says, we have no jobs. Come back in 20 years. And that's when California discovered the miracle of adjuncts. And they began hiring, you know, people by the piece. And it's really piecework. You get paid per class. And those were the only jobs available for years.
And isn't that still an issue?
Absolutely. And it's got worse. It's gotten worse since then. I mean, you know, colleges are overwhelmingly dependent on hiring and underpaying, you know, people who are qualified professors who have done all the work to be able to get a full-time job, but they just don't create full-time jobs. And it's a very exploitative system. And so my first union activity was really in the AFT. I became the organizer for a local union in a community college district south of San Francisco. And I was an organizer. I was organizing professors, and I did that for about a year and a half. And then decided I wanted to do something else, and I went and got a job in a factory. I wanted to learn more about blue-collar workers.
Okay.
So I got a job in Silicon Valley and worked in an electronics factory for about 2 years.
Okay. Were you involved in any struggles during that period?
We tried to set up an organizing committee. We couldn't find a union that was willing to take on that employer. It was a huge employer. But, actually succeeded in forming an organizing committee, which was, you know, scary. Because they kept threatening to fire me.
Well, that's a surprise, Judy.
I know.
Shocked.
I know.
So what brought you to Kansas City? How'd you end up here?
Oh, I came to Kansas City with a whole bunch of people who were involved in organizing. And I got a job in a factory here, working as a lathe machinist. Well, I worked my way up to lathe machinist. I started as an assembler in a pump factory here. And became a member of the United Steelworkers
Union. Was that a pretty unusual job for a woman?
Oh, yeah. There were very few women. And, in fact, I bid, in under union contracts, you can bid on jobs. And if you have the seniority to get a job, then you get the job if you have the basic qualifications. And I had the basic qualifications. And I bid on a job, and they didn't give it to me. This was about 1979. They didn't give me the job. They gave it to a man. And he had less seniority than me. And so I think that's when I filed my first grievance. And the union president was great. He told me, he said, you should be getting this job, and I'm going to fight for you to get this job, because they clearly violated the contract. And they put me through tests that they invented that they had never given to any man. I had a strength test. I had to show that I could tighten in a part. It's called chuck in a part, so that it wouldn't fly out and kill somebody. Nobody else ever had to do that. And then I had to take an oral test on machine speeds for various types of metal, cast iron, steel, brass. Nobody had to do that. And it wasn't part of the basic qualifications for the job, but they made me do it. And I had just taken a machine shop class, so I actually knew the stuff. And I'll never forget the look on the HR guy's face. Name was Buck. And he was astounded when I passed his friggin' test.
Well, they're probably not used to an academic taking those kind of tests.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So they had to give me the job. We later nailed that company on lots of sex discrimination issues. The Office of Federal Contract Compliance came in and issued an order to them that they had to change their practices.
We're talking with Judy Ansel, who is the Executive Director of Heartland Labor Reform here on KKFI, is also the founder and driving force for Cross Border Network, and also for the labor education class at UMKC that I can't remember the name of.
Worker Education and Labor Studies.
Okay, Institute for Labor Studies still rolls off my tongue. But anyway.
Oh, no. They made me change it.
How did you come by getting the gig at what was then the Institute for Labor Studies?
Well,
Tell that story a little bit.
I went back to teaching in about 1983 and was, again, teaching adjuncts. I taught at Longview. I taught at Avila. I taught at KCK Community College and really wanted to find a full-time job teaching history. Walter Pearson, remember him?
I do very well.
Okay, he had founded the Institute for Labor Studies, and he was leaving. And I started, before he decided to leave, I started doing research for him for unions. It was contract research for preparation for organizing and bargaining. And so it was basically corporate research to try to let them know whether, you know, a target was a good target and whether or not, if they organized a company, whether they'd be able to afford to negotiate a contract with them. Useful things to know if you're going to do that. And Walter was leaving, and he encouraged me to apply for his job. And I said, well, I've never done labor education before. And he said, you can do it. And he also arranged for me to have a lot of help. So I applied for the job, and they did a national search, but I got the job. And so I've been doing that ever since 1988.
Now, did Walter create that kind of out of whole cloth? And
yes.
What I'm wondering about is, was that sort of an orphan thing, that if it weren't for Walter, there would not have been a labor education thing?
Right. Because
and how much of that carries forward to today?
Well, there was a labor education program in Columbia, which still exists today, and it was supposed to serve the entire state, but it wasn't doing a particularly good job of serving Kansas City. And Walter thought, and a number of other people thought, that there was a real need to have a program here. And so, yes, he actually managed to put it together. And it was a joint program of UMKC and Longview. And it continued to be a joint program until about 2000. Longview dropped out, and it just became a program of UMKC. Actually, in the beginning, the Labor Beacon was part of it, too. So, yeah, Walter was able to pull that off. And then he went on to become National Education Director for the Bakery Workers Union.
So how much of a struggle has it been to keep Institute for Labor Studies or its later configuration going? Has it been hard?
Yeah, it has been hard. And it's hard for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, I think fundamentally, you know, we live in an era of a declining labor movement. And so it's really hard to maintain the political support for the program. And there have been several attempts to get rid of it. The most recent was quite a while ago now, in 2011, when we were attacked by Andrew Breitbart.
I was wondering if you'd tell that story.
Oh,
do you mind
God.
Telling it?
Well, yeah. How much time do you have?
Well, I don't know. Tell it anyway.
All right. Well,
I mean, for a reminder, Andrew Breitbart is at least the namesake of where, Steve Bannon. Came out of, so that it's still in the news these days. So those
right at this point, it was controlled by Andrew Breitbart himself,
the namesake,
He had these web pages called BigGovernment.com and BigEducation.com and who knows what. Very right wing, hated unions, of course, and hated anything on the left. And I was team teaching a course with a guy named Don Giljam, who was a union leader from St. Louis. And the course was both offered at UMKC and at University of Missouri St. Louis, UMSL. And we used the interactive video network. And there was a student who signed up for the class who was a senior at Washington University, who we later found out was put up to take this class in order to be able to attack us. And we routinely recorded the sessions because it was TV and it was real easy to do, and we made it available to students who might miss class. So one day in April, just towards the end of spring semester in 2011, I get a phone call from a dean in St. Louis saying, "Go to such and such webpage. Our phone is ringing off the hook, demanding your head." And I said, "What?" And I went to this webpage, biggovernment.com. And there I find a video of our class, only it's not what we actually taught. It's been completely chopped up and remixed. Makes it seem like we're teaching our students violence, sabotage, communism, you name it.
Not unlike what they did with Planned Parenthood.
Or what they did with ACORN, or what they did with the Agricultural Department employee Shirley Sherrod. They've attacked a number of people by using this sort of chop shop video editing in order to distort what they've actually said. And I mean, it was appalling. And this was being put out in St. Louis through the St. Louis Tea Party. They were generating all sorts of phone calls demanding that Don and I be fired. And my phone starts ringing off the hook from reporters. And the provost, I contact the provost's office and I say, "Look, this is going on. Let me assure you that this is not what I'm teaching." And they said, "Get me the proof that it isn't."
So thank God for those recordings you guys were
doing. Thank heaven for the recordings, because I had the real recordings. And so I stayed up all night finding all of the places where the edits had been made, and explaining that and giving them a transcript. And that was like on a Monday or Tuesday, I think, Tuesday. And then, 4 days elapsed. Meanwhile, the phone's still ringing off the hook, and I'm getting these nasty death threats by email. And poor Don, he was getting phone calls at home of death threats. "We know where you live. You know, better not go out in your backyard." Stuff like that. Really terrifying. Besides that, Don was fired from his union job because the State Federation of Labor freaked out and wanted to disassociate themselves from us, which really hurt, I have to say.
Yeah.
And Don was fired from his job at UMSL. He was an adjunct. And then on Friday, the provost made a statement to the media saying that these tapes are phony and that they have been falsely accused. But all through that period, there had been demands from top administration to fire me. And she stood up to them. Gail Hackett. To thank her for that.
Yeah,
let me just say that what helped enormously were the actions of our students who began to organize. I mean, we teach people how to organize.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah. And they started doing media activism themselves, and they unleashed a barrage of phone calls to the administrators trying to save our jobs. But also my association, the United Association for Labor Education, which is a national organization, actually U.S. and Canada, and internationally, UMKC and UMSL were getting emails from all over the world defending us, and that helped too. At one point, a dean said to me, "Would you please stop the emails?" Well, resistance works.
Yeah.
And if you give in and you fold up and you do nothing, you will lose.
So, rather than get into a whole lot of things in labor that we could talk about in the short amount of time remaining, I want to switch gears a little bit to cross-border network. What do you think is the most underreported story about what's going on in Latin America?
The most underreported story that I care about is the role of the U.S. government in arming absolute thugs and murderers. And I've done a lot of work in Honduras. I've been to Honduras 6 times, I think it is now, most recently last August, and witnessed, interviewed tons of people, in the resistance to the illegitimate government there, people involved in the war on the war on drugs, indigenous leaders, union leaders, Navy captains. I once interviewed the head of the DEA, our DEA in Honduras. And, you know, I see the tremendous extent that the U.S. government controls the government down there and the tremendous amount of arms and bullets and all sorts of things and training they give to people who are where they are, there is complete impunity. You assassinate somebody and you get away with it. And no accountability on the part of our government. And so I think that's the most underreported thing. The same thing goes on in Guatemala and El Salvador.
I mean, it's been going on for,
This has been going on since at least the Spanish American War.
We're aware of the stories from the 50s anyway, but now it seems
like
this
is going on. Well,
in
the 80s and the Contra Wars and stuff.
Yeah, and this seems to be going so far under the radar that, you know, it's certainly...
That's right. It's reported, but not very much and not by the mainstream media. Amy Goodman does a very good job with it sometimes.
Yeah.
But... It's underreported. But the other thing that's underreported is the amount of resistance that goes on, and the bravery of people there who know that there's no rule of law and they can be killed without any kind of repercussions. The impunity rate in Honduras is 95%.
So that means that's how many people get away with what you're
saying. 95 out of 100 crimes. Get away with it. So.
Okay, well, switching gears again, we've only got a few minutes left, but I want to. Yeah. It's all right. We can skip around. There's just too much stuff to cover it all in this 30-minute interview. But I wanted to ask you your thoughts on Trump, and I want to frame it this way.
Oh my gosh.
I know that we could spend an hour talking about, you know, the boorish narcissist, but I mean, at least ostensibly, he's anti-NAFTA, he's anti-TPP, he's for more infrastructure. At least he gives lip service to saying universal health coverage, and he has an open dialogue with some of the labor leaders that come in. So why wouldn't you be square for somebody with that kind of program? And I'll let you respond however you want to that.
Trump is a rich authoritarian crook who is all out for himself. And I don't know any other way to put it. I mean, you know, what comes out of his mouth changes by the minute. I wouldn't rely on any promises he's made. And so, you know, whether he's for NAFTA or against NAFTA is immaterial to me. Even if he's against NAFTA, it's for all the wrong reasons. He's a national. He says he's a nationalist. I don't think he really is. I mean, because he's a huge international businessman. But you know, he plays that game, and he talks about America first. But it's really Trump first. And what's wrong with NAFTA has nothing to do with America versus Mexico. It has to do with the rich versus everybody else. And if they're going to fix NAFTA. Well, I wouldn't trust him to even touch NAFTA, to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about NAFTA then, because it's another way. I'm trying to see if I can ask questions that maybe make you a little bit uncomfortable answering, or, you know, just because it maybe makes it more compelling. There are those that the whole business of deporting and the immigration and the wall and all that crap. It's mostly reported that the net immigration now is close to zero.
It's less than zero.
Less than zero.
Yeah.
But there are some who have said, well, things have improved in Mexico over the last several years. There's more, the wages are higher, so therefore more Mexican workers can stay in Mexico and earn a living. And some give some credit to that to NAFTA. And so do you think that there's some validity to that, so that
there's
some
good people,
and bad in NAFTA? I just – your response.
Well, clearly
that.
Some people have gotten rich off of NAFTA for sure, and some people have gotten jobs. There's a technocratic class in Mexico that's benefited because of all the foreign direct investment in the export factories. And, in the auto industry – People who are above the laborer level have benefited from it. The problem is the vast majority of Mexicans are farmers and workers, and they have very little education, and they don't have many skills, and they have been destroyed by NAFTA. So there's always going to be people who win, you know, but it's a class issue. And just as, you know, like most blue-collar workers in this country lost – because of NAFTA and our other trade agreements. The same thing is true in Mexico. But in Mexico, they had a much larger farming population, and those are the huge losers of NAFTA. I mean, you know, you look at most of the immigration that's come out of Mexico since NAFTA, and most of those people are bankrupt farmers. That's who comes to the United States. And they may stop for a while and do a little bit of wage work somewhere in an urban center, but they can't earn enough. They can't earn enough to survive, so they jump the border. But, you know, we started going down to Mexico and visiting the maquilas back in the starting in about 1996. And, you know, over and over again, you know, it didn't matter whether you worked for General Motors or Ford or General Electric or Emerson or, you know, Zenith, which now is LG, it's Korean. And, you know, no matter where, you know, they pay wages of hunger. And the wages in the maquilas haven't changed significantly. It's, you know, the most you're going to earn as an unskilled laborer in a maquila in Mexico today is $7 a day. You can't survive on that, you know, so you have to send family members to the U.S., you know, and most of those people are bankrupt farmers, you know, so, you know, they move north to the border and then they're within throwing distance of the U.S., and that hasn't changed since NAFTA.
Well, I've got 100 more questions to ask, but only about one more minute to ask them, so I'm just going to say, Judy, we could do this probably for another hour, but we don't have time.
Oh, I gave you my juiciest stories.
There you go. I appreciate it very much. An old friend, and I have said this in public, and I'll say it again on the radio. She's always been one of my heroes who walks the walk and talks the talk. So many people on the left that I know of think that if you have enough meetings, you're actually doing something. But Judy believes in having meetings and planning, then actually going and doing things.
Well, so, we try.
Yeah. Thanks for all you do, and good luck with all your endeavors. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
And just a reminder, Judy Ansel is the executive director of the Heartland Labor Forum, which covers all issues about working people. And it's on KKFI every Thursday from 6 to 7 with a repeat broadcast Friday morning at 5 a.m.